On this episode of Extreme Injustice goes national. In a closely divided North Carolina, America's ninth largest state, politics has taken a dangerous turn, moving from the campaign trail to the court bench. Little known to the public, four state Supreme Court justices are considering a legal maneuver that threatens the credibility and viability of the state's highest court for decades to come. Two constitutional amendments, 9.6 million votes, and the fate of two duly elected Supreme Court justices hang in the balance. The Wall Street Journal calls it scorched earth judging, writing that if successful, this institutional mischief will reverberate far beyond North Carolina. How did we get here? And where are we going? And will raw partisan politics alter the courts for generations, throwing our constitutional order into chaos? Reported by the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation, I am your host, Dallas Woodhouse, and this is Extreme Injustice. Welcome back to Extreme Injustice. It was back on September 8th that Carolina Journal first reported that one state Supreme Court case could destroy the court for years to come. It was a scheme to overturn the voters' will and set an absurd precedent that can irreparably harm our judicial system for years to come. It was just about a month later that Carolina Journal's reporting went national, and it was in the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to my sidekick and adult supervision, Mitch Kokai.
And we're going to tell you a little bit about how it did go national, as Dallas just alluded to. There was an editorial board piece in the Wall Street Journal with this headline: "Scorched Earth Judging in North Carolina, a liberal state Supreme Court gambit threatens political legitimacy." I'm going to read you just at least a little bit of the first part of this. Donald Trump tried to overturn at least three state elections in 2020, but liberal groups in North Carolina are trying to overturn or sidestep four separate elections in that state from 2018 and 2020. Unlike the U.S. Supreme Court in 2020, a filing last week, and this was on October 3rd that this appeared, so in late September, suggests North Carolina's Supreme Court is willing to entertain the political revanchists' claims. That's quite a bit of argument from the Wall Street Journal that this is a real legitimate concern, Dallas.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, of course, what allowed the Wall Street Journal to write that piece and talk about it was once the court in its late September filing indicated that they had questions for the attorneys about forced recusals. It showed them that what we were talking about is true, and it was likely to happen in North Carolina.
Yeah, and if you want, I could read a little bit more from the editorial. So you heard the first paragraph. Now, the headline alluded to scorched earth politics. That comes back in this editorial. "The scorched earth politics at work are elaborate, so bear with us," the editorial reads. "The two elections immediately under fire are a 2018 state referendum capping North Carolina's income tax at 7% and another referendum requiring photo identification for in-person voting in the state. North Carolina's constitutional amendment process requires a 3/5 majority of the legislature to put a measure on the ballot and then for the public to ratify it in a referendum. The Republican legislature placed the tax and voting amendments on the ballot in 2018, and voters approved them by about 15 and 11 percentage points, respectively." We've already alluded to this. This was in the first episode. This was the 2018 election. Six referendums on the ballot, four of them passed, including the two that are at issue in this case that's been dubbed NAACP v. Moore.
Right. I think an important part about that editorial is it point out something that we've said. When it gets into the recusals that are now potentially being forced on Tamara Berenger and Phil Berger Jr., their positions and their backgrounds were well known by the voters. I mean, the leader of our state Senate, he's on television constantly. Senator Phil Berger Sr. has led the Senate now for over a decade. His son ran for Congress. In full disclosure, I worked on his congressional campaign for a little bit. Actually, here's an interesting story, Mitch. He fired me.
Now, and you still talk to him?
I still talk to him. No, this is one of the reasons I got so interested in this is that in 2014, Phil Berger Jr. was running for Congress in a seat. And I went in and I helped him get his campaign set up and run. But the seat was sort of located in Greensboro. I was over in Raleigh. And so it just didn't work out very well for either of us. So once he got the campaign up and running, you know, I moved on. Phil Jr. is not his dad. And I'm going to talk about this in future episodes. They have different personalities. They have different mannerisms. And quite frankly, I didn't think Phil Jr. made the best candidate for Congress. The voters picked Mark Walker, who went on. Walker was from Greensboro, Guilford County, a bigger county. Phil Jr. was from Rockingham County. And Mark Walker won the primary. And, you know, Phil Jr., he ran a good campaign, but sometimes he looked a little uncomfortable. So take you to 2016. I am at that time the executive director of the North Carolina Republican Party. I have to do some candidate recruitment, and we needed somebody to run for the Court of Appeals. I knew that Phil Berger Jr. would be a good judge. I had worked with him. I knew he had a command of the law. But getting him to agree to run, and of course it was my job as executive director of the state Republican Party to convince him to do it. And I talked to him, and he didn't want to do it. And I talked to him, and we talked a little bit about his congressional campaign. I said, this is different. You know, you can talk about the law. You can ride around in your Jeep. You know, you get to meet people. I actually ran a poll and showed him I thought he would do well. And finally, my last call to him before he said yes, I threatened to drive to where he was and beat the ever-living snot out of him if he didn't agree. Because not only this, I had a job to have him run, but I also knew he would be good at it. And it was a great opportunity for him. And, of course, he was elected to the Court of Appeals in 2016 and then elected to the state Supreme Court in 2020.
Let's get back to that editorial before going on. We'll talk a little bit because you alluded to the fact that the editorial in the Wall Street Journal under that headline, Scorched Earth Judging in North Carolina, talks about some of the arguments that were made against both Phil Berger Jr., who you've just been talking about, and Tamara Berenger. The plaintiffs in this case, reminder that it's the NAACP, back in July, we're reading from the editorial in the Wall Street Journal again, they filed a motion for the two justices elected in 2020 to be removed from the case. The pretext, and that's the Wall Street Journal's words, the pretext is that Justice Berenger served in the North Carolina State Legislature when the constitutional amendments were passed, and Justice Berger's father is a GOP legislative leader and therefore named as a defendant as a stand-in for the state. Yet, and you alluded to this already, the public and the press were well aware of this high-profile case and the justices' backgrounds when they were elected back in 2020. Past service as a legislator is not normally disqualifying from hearing cases related to legislation passed during that service. And removing a judge at a court of last resort requires a higher burden since that judge can't be replaced.
Yeah, important. That's important. Yeah. Is it on what you have a, you know, if you remove a judge in a lower court, they can be replaced by somebody else. You get to the appeals court, and of course, nobody can replace the Supreme Court. Now, Mitch, I want to read the last part.
There
is
you
that
go.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, if I read the last part, this is the final part that I think is important. From the Wall Street Journal, it's worth reviewing the radicalism of what may be transpiring. Democrats in North Carolina lost policy votes in 2018 around taxation and voting and elections for the state's highest court in 2020. Now, liberal interests are seeking to reverse their 2018 election defeats using the courts. It would be one thing to challenge policy through the normal judicial process. But because Democrats lost seats on the state Supreme Court in 2020, they want to effectively undo the impact of those elections on this case with selective removal of the justices. What's remarkable is the advocates' claim and their tactics in serially subverting the judgment of voters that they are somehow defending democracy. If successful, the Wall Street Journal says, this institutional mischief will reverberate well beyond North Carolina. I know that's what I believe. That's what Mitch believes. That's what we believe at Carolina Journal. How exactly did we get here? And where do we go from here? That after a break on Extreme Injustice.
Extreme Injustice, an investigative project of Carolina Journal, is produced by the John Locke Foundation. For three decades, Locke has served as an independent, nonprofit think tank that works for truth, freedom, and the future of North Carolina. Locke envisions a strong North Carolina committed to individual freedom, personal responsibility, and limited constitutional government. To support our work, please visit johnlocke.org. Carolina Journal is your source for news and commentary covering politics and public policy. As a project of the John Locke Foundation, Carolina Journal is a pioneer in nonprofit investigative journalism. Our work has exposed corruption, conflicts of interest, and misuse of taxpayer funds by public officials, including members of Congress and the state legislature. Now, our attention is squarely focused on the North Carolina Supreme Court with our in-depth investigative series, Extreme Injustice. Visit carolinajournal.com to learn more.
Thanks for sticking around with us. I'm Dallas Woodhouse, joined again by Mitch Kokite. So we're going to pick up our story. Quick review, just to remind you that in 2018, North Carolina voters overwhelmingly approved two amendments. One would require voter ID as a constitutional requirement for photo ID, wildly popular with North Carolina voters. The other was a lowering of the state income tax maximum rate from 10% to 7%. We're actually under 7% now under Republican leadership in the General Assembly. So that doesn't really change a lot right now. But the NAACP has set its sights on erasing those two amendments, even though they were approved by the legislature, because the General Assembly was found to have been racially gerrymandered. This was a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court.
And a very interesting decision by the NAACP, Dallas, to attack just those two amendments, even though voters passed four. So basically, they only opposed the amendments they really didn't like, even though their argument that the General Assembly was unconstitutionally put in place would apply to all four amendments and could apply to almost anything the General Assembly did, which is, I'm sure, something we're going to get into.
Yeah, the other two amendments were, of course, a crime victims amendment that required certain things, a constitutional right to hunt and fish. Those things are looked at as somewhat not controversial, but I would make the argument that in the future, something may be controversial about them, or somebody may just want to sue to overturn them because they can. And so I think if the Supreme Court votes to invalidate the first two amendments on voter ID and income tax, these amendments are in real danger too.
They are. And I think you would agree that people who don't like other things that the General Assembly did during that time period that weren't constitutional amendments, they might go to court too and say, hey, if this argument worked for the amendments, why not for things that the voters didn't even have a chance to consider, like a state budget or a law we didn't like?
Well, more importantly, what concerns me is I think that it doesn't make any sense. Like, this whole thing is political. Judge Collins, a Wake County judge, put out a ridiculous ruling. The idea that two amendments that went on the ballot and were voted for by the people is invalid, but all the other statutes, all the other general laws that were passed could stand is ridiculous and something that that I don't think would work. And what concerns me about that would be in the future would be the criminal statutes. Anybody who has been convicted under laws that have been altered in perhaps the last decade, because the legislature has been in place since 2012, that they could challenge their conviction under that. But Mitch, why don't you pick up and tell us how we got to this point?
Right. And obviously, for people who would like to read about some of what we are talking about here, they could find all of the work that Dallas has done at the Carolina Journal website, carolinajournal.com. He has had a series of stories, and we've been really using the first story that you wrote about this as kind of the basis of the beginning episodes for this podcast. We're right now looking, turning the clock back to the fall of 2018. When the fight really started before voters went to the polls. In August of 2018, the North Carolina Conference of the NAACP and a group called Clean Air Carolina, they sued to block four proposed amendments passed by three-fifths of the General Assembly from being presented to voters for approval during the November 2018 election. The NAACP argued in part, this was the first time we saw this argument come out in this case, that the General Assembly itself was an unconstitutional usurper body, that it did not have any authority to put these amendments on the ballot. At the time, that effort failed. So the amendments ended up on the ballot. People voted for them.
November of 18, the amendments passed by wide margins, enshrining in the state constitution the right to hunt and fish, expansion of the rights of crime victims, the cut on the income tax from 10% to 7%, and a requirement that voters present a state-approved photo identification to vote. Some 2 million people voted to lower North Carolina state constitutional cap. It passed with about 57% and won by more than a half a million votes. The voter ID amendment was a little closer, but it passed with about 55% and passed by 405,000 votes.
And also to put this in perspective, that was an off-year election, so it wasn't a presidential election, but there were some interesting statewide races on the ballot, and both of those amendments that were challenged, the tax cap amendment and the voter ID amendment, got more votes than any candidate on the ballot,
right,
including the judicial candidates who are on the ballot, one of whom is now one of the justices deciding this case. I think the tax cap amendment got voter ID amendment got 200,000 more votes than Justice Anita Earls, who's one of the Supreme Court justices now deciding this case. Now, as you wrote in your story, before the ink was dry on the election results, the NAACP filed a lawsuit. And in February of 2019, not too long after the election in which the voters acted, Wake County Superior Court Judge Brian Collins ruled in favor of the NAACP, saying that the two challenged amendments, the income tax amendment and the photo ID amendment, were unconstitutional because, in his view, the legislators who placed them on the ballot were usurpers elected illegally by tainted district maps. So I'm going to read directly from the opinion that Judge Collins wrote. Thus, the unconstitutional racial gerrymander tainted the three-fifths majorities required by the state constitution before an amendment proposal could be submitted to the people for a vote, breaking the requisite chain of popular sovereignty between North Carolina citizens and their representatives. That's the end of the quote. So as a result, the constitutional amendments at that point from the ruling from Judge Collins were wiped off the ballot, but of course that decision was appealed.
We've used the word unprecedented before and many times, but this is really unprecedented. No state court that we're of, or federal court anywhere in the country, in the history of the United States, has declared an entire legislative body invalid. And of course this works against the U.S. Supreme Court's thinking, that even though they found the legislature to be an unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered districts, they sent that same legislature back to draw those districts. And we're going to talk more about the redistricting component of this because the rules have changed a lot for Republicans. They've tried to comply. If your attitude is, well, if they had just drawn the districts right, we wouldn't have this mess. It's a lot more complicated than that. In September of 2020, the North Carolina Court of Appeals reinstated the two amendments, and the decision by the Court of Appeals really eviscerated Judge Collins. And I'll read to you from Court of Appeals Judge Chris Dillon, who said, if there was a loss of popular sovereignty by our General Assembly, then all the laws passed by that body would be subject to attack, thus creating chaos and confusion. One might argue that the current state constitution adopted in 1971 was void, as it was proposed by a General Assembly that only had one African American member due to the impact of gerrymandering and voter suppression methods. Judge Donna Stroud, who was on that
case, gave a different reason,
and she pointed out to what I talked about how the U.S. Supreme Court had said it was okay for this General Assembly to redraw the districts. In more than 200 years in the state of North Carolina, North Carolina Supreme Court justices have never forced their own off of cases. Normally, recusals are left for individual judges to decide, and service in the General Assembly has certainly not been a reason to be removed.
So there was a motion, Dallas, filed by the defendant's lawyers that said, and we're going to quote from it, in this appeal, plaintiff asks this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and become the first court of review ever to find that a legislature lost its popular sovereignty and lacked the ability to pass legislation. The legislative acts at the center of the challenge are two proposed constitutional amendments that were later adopted in 2018 by the people of North Carolina. And this is interesting, Dallas, because if the Democrats on the Supreme Court end up doing what we're talking about, an extreme injustice, and remove two Republican justices from even hearing this case, they would end up nullifying, as you have counted up and tallied yourself, something like 9.6 million legally cast votes.
Now, the ironic part of this, and this is going to come up in our next episode, is the real serious conflict of interest is actually by Democrat Anita Earls. She has been on the been paid by the NAACP. She was their lawyer for a number of years. She even did something which I think is really egregious. Now, let me explain something to you. I'm not for all this recusal stuff. I think the voters have made their selections. I didn't vote for Anita Earls. I wasn't happy she won, but she was a well-known liberal, an activist. The voters selected her. But if you really want to talk about an egregious conflict of interest, it is Anita Earls that has that. Again, she was an attorney for the NAACP. Even after Judge Collins ruled, we talked about Judge Collins ruling that invalidated the amendments, she headlined a fundraiser for the NAACP, actually helped the plaintiffs raise money. So if anybody shouldn't be here in this case, it is Anita Earls. Now, where are we today? So the North Carolina Supreme Court, in an order actually signed by Anita Earls, has asked the lawyers representing the NAACP and the lawyers representing the General Assembly on behalf of the state of North Carolina, a series of questions. Those questions are about forced recusals, how it would work, who has the power to enforce them. That is going to be coming up on our next episode. But this plan that we have seen to overthrow the two amendments and forcibly remove the two justices is a clear political play because Democrats are afraid of voter ID becoming reality in North Carolina. Also, they want the ability to raise taxes tremendously in the future. The damage to our most treasured institutions, including the judiciary, would last for decades. The bottom line that I will leave with you today, the Supreme Court is elected to decide cases, not who sits on the Supreme Court. The voters do that. Until next time, I'm Dallas Woodhouse with Mitch Kokai, and this is Extreme Injustice. Extreme Injustice is an investigative project of the Carolina Journal and produced by the John Locke Foundation. It is written and hosted by me, Dallas Woodhouse, with adult supervision from our senior political analyst, Mitch Kokai. Creative design by Greg Dedug, with communication support from Brooke Medina. Donna King is the editor-in-chief of the Carolina Journal. Donald Bryson is the president of the John Locke Foundation. And Amy Cook is the publisher and CEO. For this story's latest development, please visit carolinajournal.com and extremeinjustice.com. Follow us on Twitter at Carolina Journal. To support this and other work of the John Locke Foundation, please visit johnlocke.org as we continue to expose extreme injustice.